This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, what a difference a week makes. Things have been evolving rapidly in the wake of more American cases of Ebola. Two healthcare workers who contracted the virus from a patient have been moved and are now being treated at a highly specialized facility, Emory University in Atlanta and the NIH facility in Maryland. And another case emerged last week in our own backyard, Margaret.
Well, that's right, Mark. A Yale student who had been on a service mission in Liberia returned to New Haven and presented with symptoms. These are just a handful of cases, but we know that public concern and worry, of course, is mounting.
The president canceled political appearances to run triage on the evolving situation from the White House. And the administration and CDC are taking a much tougher approach to the outbreak.
CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden has issued additional guidelines on the use of the right kind of protective gear in the clinical environment if a patient has symptoms. They're recommending additional layers of protective clothing to minimize the risk of exposure to health workers. And it should be noted, Mark, that while all hospitals and healthcare facilities have protective, what we call personal protective equipment, this is really very specific, very protective clothing that has to be put on in a certain way, taken off in a certain way, and that requires training. And the nation's largest union that represents close to 200,000 nurses has issued really a stern rebuke to the healthcare system, saying that that level of training and protection just hasn't been made available to frontline nurses and the entire medical team.
Margaret, you're right on target there. The word training is the operative one, and our hospital systems are not equipped. And the top officials at Texas Presbyterian Health took responsibility for their flawed initial response to the presence of Ebola in their hospital. He admits that mistakes were made, but part of this is the lack of a national strategy around training hospital and healthcare workers.
Well, this one is something of a new challenge for the American healthcare system, but all medical crises have in common that there's an opportunity to learn quickly from mistakes and move to adopt best practices to prevent future breaks and to improve outcomes. And certainly, it's pretty safe to say that we have a very solid healthcare delivery infrastructure here in the United States, so I don't think we'll see an acceleration of outbreaks in this country, but we just don't know exactly how this is going to unfold.
Meanwhile, there's an epidemic of another kind at work in this country, Margaret. October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. It's the second leading cause of death in women under 50.
We know, as people engaged in primary care, how complex this issue is. And we are so pleased today to have a guest who is a global expert on this topic.
That she is, Dr. Jacqueline Campbell, currently serves as co-chair of the Institute of Medicine's Forum on the Prevention of Global Violence. She's developed a highly successful diagnostic tool for clinicians, law enforcement, and patients to determine their risk for further violence.
The lethality assessment profile that she has developed is among one of the most highly regarded in the field, Mark. Dr. Campbell has some great information on how providers, as well as law enforcement, might be better equipped to address the issue in their patients and in their communities.
And Lori Robertson joins us from factcheck.org. She's always on the front line of misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Jacqueline Campbell in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The response to Ebola in West Africa and now on American shores has begun to amp up in the policy sector as well as the healthcare sector. The CDC is rethinking its approach to how best to contain infection should it become more prevalent in the U.S. The initial thinking was every hospital in the nation should be prepared to identify, diagnose, isolate, and treat anyone suffering from Ebola infection. It may not be the best approach, according to some experts who recently gathered at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health to discuss the Ebola epidemic. Now the thinking is there should be dedicated hospitals around the country who have full capacity for isolation and quarantine as well as adequate systems to treat the illness of many if need be. Meanwhile, the scope of the outbreak in West Africa continues to confound global health officials. The World Health Organization warns there could be 10,000 new cases per week. Cuba has the largest national presence on the ground in three West African countries. Meanwhile, there's a shortage of doctors in this country, especially in primary care. The National Health Services Corps has been around since the 1970s to address the shortage of primary care practitioners in rural settings, and financial support for that program was increased to about $250 million by 2015. But the money isn't guaranteed beyond 2015, and a number of organizations, the American Academy of Family Physicians, American College of Physicians, and the American Nurses Association, have all signed letters to Congress urging them to keep the funding intact beyond next year. And while millions more Americans have health coverage under the Affordable Care Act, many are still avoiding going to the doctor. About 20% of Americans avoiding seeking medical treatment due to the perceived cost, even those with health coverage. And a missing link found in the quest to find a cure for Alzheimer's? Researchers at Mass General in Boston have grown diseased brain cells, being called Alzheimer's in a dish. These cells can be grown quickly in a dish that allows researchers to test compounds quickly that can combat Alzheimer's. It's being hailed as a giant leap forward in the field. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Jacqueline Campbell, the Anna D. Wolf Chair at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing, and she also holds a joint appointment at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. She's an international expert on domestic and intimate partner violence and its impact on public health. Dr. Campbell is National Program Director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Nurse Faculty Scholars. She currently serves as co-chair of the Institute of Medicine's Forum on the Prevention of Global Violence. She's won numerous awards, including the American Society of Criminology Vollmer Award, and serves as chair of the board of directors of Futures Without Violence. She earned her BS in nursing from Duke and her PhD in nursing from the University of Rochester. Dr. Campbell, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, you know, October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, an important time to examine the issues, and especially in light of all the recent publicity surrounding well-known professional athletes. But before we dive into the assessment models you've developed, could you give our listeners an analysis of the deep prevalence of domestic violence in our culture? Just how commonplace is domestic violence in this country?
Well, unfortunately, at least 30% of women in this country have experienced physical violence and or sexual assault or stalking from a husband, boyfriend, ex-husband, ex-boyfriend, or same-sex partner or ex-same-sex partner sometime in their lifetime. So all too common.
Well, Dr. Campbell, because it's so common, it is critical that in healthcare, people on the front lines be very attuned to the possibility of intimate partner violence. But how effective have we been at getting primary care providers to screen for intimate partner violence, to recognize it? And what are the signs and symptoms beyond physical manifestations that providers should be alert for in thinking about whether a woman might be at risk or experiencing violence?
Well, we have found where primary care providers do assess for domestic violence, we get far more disclosure of domestic violence when they actually ask. We have been successful in increasing our screening practices in primary care when, first of all, the providers are trained. It doesn't have to be a long training, but at least some sort of a brief training about the importance of doing this. Also, when the providers know that there's someone in their system that they can help get an abused woman to talk to. So it's very important for them to know who within their system is able to help them if it's a very difficult kind of a situation, which it often is. We also find that it's helpful if there is, in the well woman's visit, mm-hmm. coverage, insurance coverage for the time that you spend doing some brief counseling with someone who is abused. And you said, you know, what should we be alert for? Well, we know that abused women are much more likely to be depressed than other women. Mm-hmm. We know that women who are abused have a whole variety of healthcare problems, mm-hmm. especially things like chronic pain. So we find it's much more important to ask everyone, and then we don't have to think about, oh, should I be asking this person versus that person.
Dr. Campbell, during your early days working as a nurse, you recognized that the healthcare and law enforcement communities needed a better risk assessment tool to intervene on behalf of battered partners, and especially in determining which battered domestic partners were more likely to experience future lethal harm. And your work's evolved to the development of the lethality assessment profile. And what's different about this new assessment tool, and how much uptake has there been in law enforcement communities around the country?
Well, first I developed the danger assessment, which is an instrument that a woman can do herself, and it's there's actually an app for that that helps her see for herself how much danger she's in. It's even better done with a domestic violence advocate at a advocacy organization or by a social worker or a nurse in the healthcare system. Then they would go on to have the danger assessment done with them, which is very accurate and helps pinpoint the actual level of danger for each woman. The LAP, which is a lethality assessment program, was developed by the Maryland Network Against Domestic Violence, along with myself and domestic violence advocates. And it is a short form of the danger assessment that was meant to be asked by first responders, law enforcement, when they are called to a scene of a domestic violence incident. It's somewhat less detailed than the danger assessment itself, and so therefore it's very user-friendly for a first responder, a police officer. The officer makes the phone call to the domestic violence advocacy organization and actually helps the victim get on the phone with that organization right there, right then. What police officers usually do is give domestic violence victims a phone number to call, and they oftentimes don't follow up on that. So we know, and we have good data to show, that it's much more effective if the police officer actually gets the victim in touch with that domestic violence advocacy organization right then on the scene. So we have, the Maryland Network has been incredibly successful at getting the LAP in use across the entire state of Maryland. We've also been very successful in terms of getting it in use in the state of Oklahoma. So now the Oklahoma legislature has passed a law that the LAP is to be used throughout the state of Oklahoma.
Well, Dr. Campbell, Mark and I have the pleasure of leading a statewide community health center, one of the very few in the country, I think, that also operates a domestic violence shelter and full community intervention program. So I want to give a shout out to our director, Michelle Waldner, who I know has been working hard in Connecticut to get the lethality assessment profile adopted here. But I'd like to ask you about another dimension of this issue, the issue of reporting or mandated reporting. I'd be so interested in your perspective on this. What's sort of the state of the country in terms of mandated reporting and some of the arguments against that or for that, as the case may be?
Part of the issue with that, and we did a whole series of research studies both to see what abused women thought about that, and actually the majority of abused women said this: I would prefer that the healthcare provider offer to call the police, but that it should be up to me in the end whether or not the police get called in on a case, because only I know if this could be harmful to me. I know, for instance, a lot of women of color know that their partner, for instance, has had some other charges against them, other legal action against them. And if they have one more arrest for something, this is going to mean significant jail time for them. And that's not what she wants. She wants the abuse to end, but not necessarily this abuser go to jail. So it's a complicated decision for her to make. Now, on the other hand, obviously, as providers, we have to obey the law. So if it is an assault with a weapon or where someone has, for instance, been choked or strangled to unconsciousness, that in those kinds of cases, the police have to be called. But for other kinds of abuse, then this is an adult person we're working with. In most states, as you said, California being the exception, the big exception, also Kentucky, where healthcare providers are not mandatory reporters of the whole range of abusive tactics. As providers, we need to do two things. We need to remember to offer to her to call the police for her, because oftentimes in the emergency department, then the police can be brought in to talk to her in privacy and that. Or we also, as providers, use something like the danger assessment to see, you know, if she's at high risk for lethality, then I, as a clinician, would be a lot more assertive.
We're speaking today with Dr. Jacqueline Campbell, the Anna D. Wolf Chair at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. She's an international expert on domestic and intimate partner violence and developed the lethality assessment profile used to predict ongoing risk for intimate partner violence. You know, Dr. Campbell, prior to forming a battered women's shelter, we actually ran a nationwide newsletter on battered women and had the good fortune of running into a young congresswoman back in the late 1970s as she just came into the House of Representatives, Barbara McCluskey, a great champion. Talk to us a little bit about the politics of this, of how this is grabbing on. It's really about making sure, as you say, that the three pillars that you want to do is to improve safety, health, and well-being are all taking place.
Of course, Barbara Mikulski is our longtime senator, and we in Maryland owe her a lot, especially around the domestic violence issues. When we look at, from a national perspective, the LAP, for those that think that the best way to address domestic violence is through the criminal justice system, the LAP gives those locales a really good way to make sure that the criminal justice part is collaborating with the domestic violence services organization. Those two sides need to work together, with the healthcare system being the third pillar. That's the best way to go at this, so that victims of domestic violence are given choices, so that all of the parts of the system are knowledgeable about how best to work together. The one place where we find that there is issues that oftentimes do get politically driven, guns being so often the domestic violence fatality means, especially the homicide suicides, and when a child is also killed, those are almost always with guns. So trying to address that, gun removal from known abusers, abusers who have been convicted of a domestic violence offense or who have an order of protection out against them, working with communities to see, no matter what their politics are, how that can really save lives. And that's a place that politics does sometimes get in the way. One of the reasons that I feel like the LAP has been a really important, and I can't credit Maryland Network Against Domestic Violence enough, that it is a means of bringing all of the sectors together through a coordinated use. And Connecticut has done a really terrific job of implementing these principles of risk assessment throughout the various parts of the system, so that now Child Protective Services is involved, the family court is involved in a really proactive way. So Connecticut is an excellent example of a statewide initiative, and Maryland is trying to be, and even Oklahoma is now with this risk assessment strategy, that it also brings together their health department and their domestic violence services organizations.
Dr. Campbell, I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you that we are always searching for the opportunity to be further upstream in our prevention efforts. And it seems that to do that, we need so much for the next generation of healthcare professionals in medicine, in nursing, in public health, in the behavioral health sciences, to have as part of their education and curriculum and training and understanding of intimate partner violence, of the impact on the next generation, of the impact on children who witness domestic violence. And you play such a prominent leadership role in the country in your position as the National Program Director for the RWJ Foundation Nurse Faculty Scholars. What's the state of the art around training of the next generation of healthcare professionals around this critical issue?
And we've been very fortunate in the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funding of Nurse Faculty Scholars. It's a process through which our National Advisory Committee does. But we've had a number of Nurse Faculty Scholars who are doing research on various aspects of violence, domestic violence, children's exposure, et cetera. So that's a really important piece of the Nurse Faculty Scholar program. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is working, their new initiatives are around a culture of health.
Right.
And they have as one of their areas within that that they've identified is addressing violence as one way of providing this culture of health for the country. So that's really exciting. And in terms of educating, training healthcare providers, I work with a number of organizations that were all interested in increasing that training, making it part of every curriculum. It's hard to get it sustained. You know, we had in the 70s and 80s some real initiatives that way, and we got it into most of the nursing curricula by the early 90s, and we were feeling really good about ourselves. And then it was sort of like things waned, even in my own school of nursing. There was a point where they said there was so much happening in the field of maternal child health nursing that they had to take out the lecture on abuse during pregnancy to replace it with more important content, you know. So those are the kinds of things that sometimes happens. I suspect right now with all of the national attention to domestic violence, we'll have another upsurge and people making sure it's in the curriculum. But it's one of those things, it's a system change issue that you have to get it systematized. The same thing with screening for domestic violence. You have to get it in the healthcare records, in the electronic medical records, a permanent place in the curriculum. Part of one of the things we do at Hopkins in the School of Medicine is we have the identified patient that medical students do some of their initial history and diagnosis skill bases on. And we've always had abused women as, you know, to play the part, or the identified patients be an abused woman to do that. And now we're working on making sure oftentimes both medical and nursing education is now based in part on simulations. So making sure that some of those simulation contents are of, you know, children that are witnessing domestic violence at home, that in that pediatric assessment, that for adult women, there's an abused woman who is one of the simulation activities, so that unless the provider finds out that they're abused, they misdiagnose or inadequately treat one of the conditions. But, you know, it takes a lot of people working on that. Fortunately, we have a lot of people, but You know, it's like you have to keep pushing.
Right.
We've been speaking with Dr. Jacqueline Campbell, the Anna D. Wolf Chair at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. You can learn more about her work going to dangerassessment.org. Dr. Campbell, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare Today.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
We write a lot about senior scare, efforts by politicians to scare seniors to get their votes. And this midterm election has included plenty of that. Nearly $50 million has been spent on television advertising in the first 9 months of the year on ads mentioning Medicare, with Democrats outspending Republicans nearly 2-1. That's according to Kantar Media Intelligence's Campaign Media Analysis Group. The spending may be new, but the claims are old. For instance, Democratic ads in several Senate and House races claim that Republicans would, quote, end the Medicare guarantee, a reference to their support of Representative Paul Ryan's Medicare plan. But Ryan's plan wouldn't end the guarantee of Medicare benefits. Instead, it proposes phasing in a government subsidy program in which future beneficiaries pick from private plans or traditional Medicare. And it wouldn't take away any guaranteed benefits either. It would require private plans to include the same minimum benefits as traditional Medicare. These claims about Ryan's plan ending Medicare first began in 2011 when he released a budget proposal that included a transition to a premium support system. We called the claim a whopper of the year then. 3 years later, Democrats have modified the claim to say the plan would end the Medicare guarantee. That doesn't make it any more accurate. And many ads feature seniors who are already on Medicare, or in one case, a man who says Medicare is, quote, around the corner for him. The Republican plan wouldn't kick in until those under age 55 reached Medicare eligibility. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. 1 in 6 people in the world lacks access to drinking water or basic sanitation, and statistics show that diarrhea is the leading cause of death for these populations. But access to clean and potable water continues to present a real challenge. In Africa, the numbers are staggering, with 46% of the residents of sub-Saharan Africa having no direct access to clean water. In 2005, artist Tracy Hawkins went to Tanzania to see what she could do about it. Clay pot water filtration has been around for several hundred years, where simple clay pots lined in the bottom with silver oxide can remove up to 99% of the impurities from most water sources, but no one had undertaken a dedicated program to produce and distribute these pots. Tracy founded the Singisi Pottery Project with a local activist and began making the pots with local artisans in this region of Tanzania. By 2008, she and her team were able to get a factory built so that they could increase production. The project has served multiple communities and continues to expand. Independent researchers have determined the system to be safe, effective, and the best part, the health of entire communities has been improved significantly once each village resident is provided with a clay filtration system. The pots are inexpensive to produce, easy to handle, and the factory has also created jobs for local residents. They have since changed the name of the organization to Safe Water Ceramics of East Africa and have continued plans to replicate their successful model across the region. A simple, easily manufactured solution that improves access to potable water for a community that previously had few options, one that improves health, well-being, and economic conditions at the same time. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.